ערוץ 7.
Hello and welcome to Life Lesson. This is Judy Simon on Israel National Radio. I grew up learning, studying that the world was created in 6 days, and on the seventh day, God rested. But I also grew up hearing that science didn't really believe that, that science had different ideas about how the world was created, about when the world was created, and about how long it took for the world to be created. So I have invited the expert on the subject, the expert on which subject? On both Torah and science. Professor Nathan Aviezer is a doctor of physics. He was the former chairman of the physics department at Bar-Ilan University, and he has written 3 books so far. His first book, In the Beginning, has been translated into 9 languages. His second book, Fossils and Faith, has been translated into 4 languages. And his third book, which just came out, is called Modern Science and Ancient Faith. Professor Aviezer teaches Torah and science at Bar-Ilan University, where he was awarded the prestigious Templeton Prize. He also organizes a Torah and Science conference yearly, which is very, very popular. He was honored by being elected as a fellow of the American Physical Society and research professor at the Royal Society of London. Professor Aviezer and his wife made Aliyah back in 1967, so he's been in Israel for quite a long time. And since then, he has lectured all around the world on the subject of Torah and science. Professor Aviezer, thank you so much for joining us on the show today.
My pleasure. Good morning.
You know, Professor Aviezer, we always begin with the past. Now, we're not going to go all the way back to creation, which is the past that I know you're most comfortable with.
I really would like to go back.
We will. We're going to start with your personal past. Can you tell me who your grandparents were?
Well, I don't know what you mean, who they were. My grandparents, well, I was born in Switzerland because my father was born in Switzerland. I thought it would be nice to be close to my parents when I was born. My mother was from Vienna. And then when she married, she moved to Switzerland with
okay.
my father, and that's where I was born.
So you're a natural Swiss chocolate.
I'm a naturalized American citizen. I came to America as a baby. I was just 3 years old, and I'm essentially an American. That's where I grew up. That's my native language. And even though technically I was born in Switzerland, but in practice I'm an American.
Okay.
Who came to Israel 40 years ago and is still struggling to learn Hebrew.
So you told us about your birth, but you skipped your grandparents.
Well, my grandparents, my grandparents are from Poland.
Okay.
My grandfather came in the First World War. He left Poland and came to Vienna. And my paternal grandparents, I don't know why they left Poland and they came to Switzerland. And my father was actually born there in 1900. I don't know why they left, but that's where they're from.
And why did your parents choose to go from Switzerland to the U.S.? What year was that?
That was in 1939. That's a very good question.
I see.
In fact, I'll tell you why they left in just a moment. Somehow, they could have gone to Palestine, but somehow my parents were sort of Zionists in principle, but not so much in practice.
Okay.
My parents left Switzerland for a very interesting reason. My father was a dentist. We lived in a suburb of Zurich here, our thriving practice, everything was fine, and we owned a 3-story building. On the ground floor was the dental office, and the first floor we lived, and on the second floor, they rented out my parents to, at that time, to 2 Swiss, I emphasize, Swiss engineers. And when my parents heard them starting to say Heil Hitler to each other, they realized it was time to go. In fact, nothing happened. They could have stayed, but I very much respect my parents. They didn't wait till it was too late to leave. They left. Better to leave when you didn't have to leave than not to leave when you had to leave. So that's how my parents left Switzerland, came to America, and my father was a dentist in America.
So they really saw the writing on the wall.
Yes. I mean, they saw the writing. As I said, there really wasn't any writing on the wall because they didn't have to leave. Nothing happened in Switzerland. In fact, we didn't go as refugees. We came to America on the Queen Mary, the biggest luxury craft that existed at that time. But they left because it looked dangerous.
Mm-hmm. I see. And where did they settle in the U.S.?
They settled in Detroit. I grew up in Detroit. Don't ask me why.
Okay.
Detroit, there's no rational reason for that, but that's where they settled. That's where I grew up. I grew up in Detroit.
What was the language in your home growing up?
Well, that's an interesting question. Even though most of my parents had German as their native language, Austria and Switzerland, because of my father's dental practice in America, it was important for him to learn English. So my parents used to speak English to each other, so my father, who was not good at languages, he could get used to English. So I normally heard English, but when my parents' friends came over, of course, they spoke German to each other. So I can understand German, but I don't really speak it very well, but their native language was German, but they spoke English generally for that purpose.
Now, what kind of a home did your parents create for you in Detroit?
It was a regular home. I'm not Bali Tshuva. We were parents were both religious. They were both from, and I grew up in a normal religious Jewish household from my birth all the time.
Jewish day school and everything?
There wasn't really a Jewish day school in Detroit at that time. Mm-hmm. I went to public school. Later, a Jewish day school started, but it wasn't very good, so essentially, I was there 1 year, but other than that, I went to a regular secular public school. At that time, all the Jews in Detroit lived in a particular neighborhood. By the way, nowadays, if a Jew says he's from Detroit, he doesn't mean Detroit, he means suburbs. I don't think there's a single Jew that actually lives in Detroit.
In fact, they say there's more Arabs in Detroit than in Ramallah.
So anyway, but at that time, all the Jews lived in the same area, and we went to the school, which was 90% Jewish. Uh-huh. Maybe 5% black and 5%, honest to goodness, white Christians.
Okay.
So, but none of the kids were from, maybe a handful. So they were all normal Jewish, non-religious kids.
Mm-hmm. And did you go to some sort of an after-school Hebrew school?
Yeah, we went to 4 to 6 Hebrew school. It was totally worthless.
Uh-huh.
So eventually what I learned about Torah and Gemara and Judaism, I learned by myself.
You learned from your family.
Well, right? I mean, I didn't learn it. I mean, we kept it, but I didn't really.
Okay.
What I know about Judaism, about Torah, is basically what I learned by myself.
You're self-taught Jew.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But was your family Zionistic when you were
a child? Yes. I said my family was Zionistic, but they were Zionistic in principle.
Mm-hmm.
Why didn't they go to Palestine in 1939? They were lived in Switzerland. There was no problem getting a certificate. This is not Eastern Europe. But it was difficult, and America was the goal of the Medina, and my parents.
They had a comfortable life in Switzerland.
A comfortable life, and they liked a comfortable life, right, so they went to America.
Okay.
Didn't want to make the desert bloom, let somebody else make the desert bloom.
Professor Aviezer, when you were a child, what did you want to be when you grew up?
I wanted to be a scientist.
All my life, really?
I never thought of anything but being a scientist.
Why?
I love science. I love all the time. I love arithmetic, I love mathematics, I love science, I'm very good at it, and I like it all the time. Modesty is not my strong point, as you can. I like to say, I used to have one defect, I wasn't sufficiently modest, but now that I've cleared that up, I'm perfect.
Now you're perfect.
Anyway, so I always was interested in science. It never entered my mind to do anything but to be a scientist.
Is it because you had excellent science teachers, or were there things in your environment that enticed you?
I don't know. I liked it. Some people like music. Some people like my wife loves art. She loves art. I love science. That's
okay, so where you went to a public high school.
What I went to a public high school.
What did you do after high school?
I played baseball. Oh, you mean the years after high school, not after the high school. In Detroit, there was a university, Wayne University, which is now called Wayne State. It isn't much of a university, but I was sort of a shy kid. And you naturally go to the local university. My parents didn't have the idea that I should go to some top-flight university. So I went there, and I was very good. In fact, I finished first in my class.
Wow.
But I realized Wayne University is not who knows what. So for my doctorate, I went to the University of Chicago, which is an outstanding.
Mm-hmm.
In the physics department, when I was there, we had 2 Nobel Prize winners on the faculty.
Wow.
And I might point out, the best teacher on the faculty was one of the Nobel Prize winners, and the worst teacher was the other one. There's no connection between excellence in research and excellence in teaching.
Interesting.
So I went there, and I have got my PhD, and I got my wife there, too, for the price of one.
Wow.
And then after that, I did a postdoctoral stint at the University of Illinois working with Professor John Bardeen. John Bardeen is the only person in history to have won two Nobel Prizes in physics. Others have won two Nobel Prizes in science, but not two Nobel Prizes in physics. And then after my postdoctoral, I somehow did well. I was invited to IBM, the Yorktown Research Labs, Watson Research Labs, north of New York. And there I was invited to the group by Professor Leo Osaki. Osaki wasn't so smart. He only won one Nobel Prize. Then from there, I came to Israel.
Basically, you rubbed shoulders in your university years with a lot of Nobel Prize winners.
That's right.
Did that make that one of your goals? You thought, well, one day I'm going to win the Nobel Prize?
I am well aware of my deficiencies. It's not a deficiency. I'm a very good scientist. I'm an excellent scientist, but I'm not of the Nobel Prize caliber. I don't sit around in November listening for the phone to ring to get the call from Sweden, not on you've won the Nobel Prize. I know where I stand.
Okay, so you met your wife when you were studying at the University of Chicago for your PhD?
She was a student, and I was a student, and we met, and the rest is history.
When did you make Aliyah?
We made Aliyah in 1967, but let me tell you about it. I wasn't really a super-duper Zionist, but my wife, she was a super-duper Zionist, and when she was in Bnei Akiva, and she did all the activities, went to camp, was a counselor, Madricha, and she was all her life to be a Zionist. And so when I proposed to her, I said, Devorah, will you marry me? And her answer was, will you take me to Israel? And I said, okay, I will. She said, okay, so will I. And we got married.
So you learned from the get-go that you've got to listen to your wife.
That's right. And then I wanted to finish my PhD and get a scientific reputation and earn a little money. And we did that. It took a few years. And then in 1967, we came to Israel.
Wait, you made Aliyah in 1967. That was the year of the war.
The year of the war, but it had no influence whatsoever. One normally gets an academic position. I received a professorship at Bar-Ilan University. One normally receives an academic position in the spring to start work in the fall. So in spring, I got my professorship, April, May, I don't recall exactly. Then started May with the crisis and June with the war, and it ended, and in September we came to Israel just as we had planned all along. Anyway, it looks like it was connected with the war, but it had nothing to do with the war. And I've been a professor of physics at Bar-Ilan ever since. I got off the plane, took a taxi to Bar-Ilan, and I've been sitting in my office for the last 40 years.
Okay. Now, during this whole time that you were studying physics, you're also, as you mentioned, an Orthodox Jew, a Torah observant Jew.
I've been an Orthodox Jew.
Did you find through your studies that there was a conflict between what they were teaching you at the university and what you believed to be true in your heart?
Actually, I never thought much about it. It never entered my mind to think about things like the creation story and how does this fit science. I was interested in science, and this didn't interest me very much. Mm-hmm. How I got interested in that is actually very interesting. My wife is a teacher, and as a teacher, there's a journal that the Teachers Union has called Ched HaChinuch, The Voice of Education. I think it should be called The Voice of Anti-Education, but never mind.
Oy.
So once there was an article there written by an important school supervisor in Tel Aviv, and he was complaining about the school. In Israel, we have two school systems, the secular general school system and the religious school system. And he was complaining about the religious school system. And his complaint was basically they teach the Torah as if it were true and therefore corrupting young minds and so on. And he listed four examples that what the Torah says is totally wrong. So my wife showed it to me. Well, nothing. What do you have to say? So I looked at it. And it turned out that every single one of his four examples was wrong. He didn't know any science. So she said, well, write a letter. I write a letter. I'm busy. No, but my wife is very persistent. And my wife says, do something. I learn I will have no peace until I do it. So I wrote a letter, and I explained why all four examples were wrong, and I sent it to them, and they published it. Fine, good. That's the end of the story. It wasn't the end of the story. 10 days later or so, I got a phone call from a principal in a religious school. He loved my letter. It was wonderful. Would I come and give a talk? Well, I don't talk. That's not what I do. I'm a scientist. I was started to explain why I wouldn't come. My wife grabbed the receiver from my hand. Yes, he will come. When should he show up? Okay, so my wife says, I have to go. So I went and I gave a talk, and it turned out that I'm actually a very good speaker. And I was getting invited, an invitation, and more invitation. And I was getting an invitation every couple of weeks to go to a different school and speak about this.
Mostly at religious schools, I have to point out.
Only religious schools. the religious schools invited me here to have me speak. Nowadays, I actually get invitations to non-religious places also. In fact, in 2 days, I'm going to be giving a talk at a non-religious framework. They also like to hear the way I present it. It's very good. Okay. So then I made a mistake. What was the mistake?
What was your mistake?
After the talk, somebody asked me, do you have anything written? I said, no, I have nothing written. So I went home and I told my wife I have nothing written. She said, oh, so sit down and write. Okay, no peace. So I wrote about the first day of creation. I wrote an essay about the first day of creation, about 10 pages long, and I made about 50, 60 copies, and I took it to my talks, and I would pass them out, and the 50 copies became 500 copies, and the 500 copies became 5,000 copies.
Whoa.
And they loved what I was talking. And then I started to do one about evolution. I gave a talk about evolution, and they loved this too, and I wrote something about evolution, and it was really very, very popular. I was amazed how people were thirsty to hear somebody who knows something about science saying something normal.
Hmm.
I remember after one of my talks, they were just grabbing my essays, my photocopied essays, hotcakes. There was one left, and two teachers grabbed it, and I thought they would kill each other. They ripped it apart like
Shlomo
and the baby, only because I promised I would mail each one a separate copy, preventing them from killing each other on the spot. So then I had a sabbatical coming. So I figured, well, I'm going to go to Cambridge, but I'm not going to do physics. So don't tell anybody about this. I'm not mad boy. I'm going to sit down and see, well, maybe there's more to be said than just two essays. So I sat down and I spent a year studying, well, what does the Torah say and what does science say? And I thought maybe I could make from this a 40, 50, 60 page pamphlet. And it turned out there was enough material for a book. And that was my first book in the beginning. I have a chapter on each of the 6 days of creation. I have three chapters on the fifth day and two chapters on the sixth day. And it turns out that with one exception, which I'll come to later, every single event described in the Torah on the first chapter, all these verses which seem impossible and crazy and anti-scientific and irrational, every single one is in complete harmony with the latest findings of science in cosmology, astronomy, geology, biology, and so on. And that's what my first book is all about.
Wow. I'm at the edge of my seat. I can't wait to hear about it.
Well, before you do, let me tell you what happened. And then I decided maybe I would translate it into Hebrew. My Hebrew is no good, but I have a son who speaks Hebrew. So he translated it into Hebrew. And then my first book is now in 9 languages. I can't believe that number.
Languages. That's how much interest there is all over the world.
Contacted me to want to buy the rights to translate the books. If you want to get a copy in Portuguese or Norwegian, there is no problem whatsoever.
Do you think that it's mostly Christians that read your book?
No. I think it is mostly Jews, but also Christians. In fact, 7 of the translations are by Jewish publishing houses, but 2 of them are by Christian publishing houses. Norway, how many Jews are there in Norway? And it's Norwegian publishing house for the non-Jewish audience bought the rights for my book.
Okay, so let's go back to the beginning. So what you're telling me, Professor Aviezer, is that there's a perfect harmony between the Torah's description of creation and science, science. Give me examples of that.
Let me give you an example. The most dramatic verse in the first chapter of Bereshit, Genesis, is the very first verse. Bereshit bara Elohim et ha-shamayim ve-et ha-aretz. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. Heaven and earth, I should say, is a Torah phrase meaning the universe, cosmos. It appears 13 times in the Torah. God is called Kone Shemayim Va'aretz, master of heaven and earth, meaning master of the universe. It doesn't mean the sky and the dirt. It's an expression for the cosmos.
Okay.
So the first verse tells us that our universe began through an act of creation, presumably creation from nothing. And for a very long time, scientists thought creation from nothing, it's impossible, it's against the laws of science. And recently there has been a reassessment in cosmology. Cosmology is the branch of science that deals with the origin and development of the universe. And the current accepted theory of cosmology is called the Big Bang Theory. I'm sure all the listeners have heard this term, the Big Bang Theory.
Sure.
The theory is supported by a vast array of scientific evidence. It is accepted by all mainstream cosmologists. The theory is taught in every university in the world. The theory was awarded the Nobel Prize in Physics. And the central theme of the Big Bang Theory is that the universe began through an act of creation. I repeat, The universe began through an act of creation. And it is interesting and instructive and exciting to quote some of the world's leading authorities on the subject of creation.
Wait a minute. I'm going to stop you for a minute, Professor Aviezer. I was always taught, and mind you, I'm not a scientist, and I'm not up on the latest scientific theories.
Nobody's perfect yet.
That, well, I'm far from it. That the Big Bang theory is that there was this one little cell that split into many cells and just split and continued to split and continued to develop into an amoeba and eventually into a alligator or chicken, whatever.
With amoeba and alligator, that's biological evolution. I'm discussing
okay.
the creation.
But
of
what
the
you're
universe.
Talking about
there's
is
no
the very.
No amoebas and no alligators.
The there very first
nothing.
Step, that very,
the first, very
first cell.
There was nothing. There was no cell. There was absolutely nothing existed. And then suddenly the world sprang into being from nothing. This is what the scientists mean when they've used the word creation. And let me quote what the scientists say. Professor Paul Dirac, he's a Nobel Prize winner from the University of Cambridge and one of the towering giants of 20th century physics. Professor Dirac writes, quote, "It seems certain that there was a definite time of creation." Note that Professor Dirac does not say it is possible, it is likely, it is reasonable. No. In the eyes of this Nobel Prize winner, it is certain that there was a definite time of creation. Now we turn to Professor Alan Guth, America's leading cosmologist, professor at MIT, Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Professor Guth writes, quote, "The instant of creation remains unexplained." We now come to Professor Joseph Silk, another important cosmologist from the University of California. Professor Silk recently wrote a book about the Big Bang, entitled The Big Bang. He has no imagination in choosing titles for his book. The very first sentence of Professor Silk's book is the following, quote, "The Big Bang is the modern scientific version of creation." And finally, we come to Professor Stephen Hawking. The cosmologist with a capital C, the superstar of the University of Cambridge. Professor Hawking writes, quote, "The creation lies outside the scope of the known laws of physics. Today, every scientist discusses the creation of the universe and uses the word creation to describe what happened, because today, every scientist can take appropriate instrumentation, carry out appropriate measurements, and thereby obtain clear and unequivocal scientific proof that the universe was in fact created. The creation of the universe is no longer some article of faith. It is no longer some sort of theological hypothesis. The creation of the universe has become a scientifically established fact."
Okay. Professor Aviezer, on that note, I'm going to stop you for a minute because we've come to the end of the first half of the show. But I know you've got a lot more to tell us, and I have a lot of questions to ask you. So stay tuned. Don't go away. We'll be right back with the second half of Life Lessons.
Shalom, dear friends. Tune in to the Derech Eretz Hour for the next show, where we're going to be talking about the life, the legacy, the passion of a giant of the rabbinate that we lost just a few weeks ago, Rabbi Joseph Aaron Kranz, of blessed memory, the longtime rabbi of Congregation Agudath Shalom in Stamford, Connecticut, but whose fame and whose power, in a sense, was literally all over the world, meeting with popes, meeting with senators, bringing people together, building bridges across races and ethnic origins. This is one show you don't want to miss. So tune in, the Derech Eretz Hour, here on Israel National Radio.
Greetings, Israel National Radio listeners. Josh Haston here, host of Reality Bites Radio. On my show this week, Chloe Valdery, a student at the University of New Orleans, who's hosting the second annual Declare Your Freedom Rally in support of Zionism. She will be my first guest, in addition to Uri Bank, the Secretary General of the Bayit HaYudi Jewish Home Party, to discuss the proposed terror prisoner release. Also on the show, an exclusive report from our very own Walter Bingham, who was at a demonstration held by the family members of the terror victims, calling on the government not to go ahead with the move. That's this week on my program, Reality Bites Radio. Don't miss one second. Josh Haston here. IsraelNationalRadio.com.
the second half of Life Lessons. We're in the middle of a conversation with Professor Natan Aviezer, professor of physics and a specialist in the area of creationism and science, the combination, the harmony between the Torah's description of the creation of the universe in six days.
Let me interrupt. I don't like the word creationism.
Okay.
I am not a creationist. I'm totally opposed to the creationist ideology.
Ooh, I want to hear more about that. But before we get into that, yeah. Professor Aviezer, you were in the middle of telling us about the harmony between Torah and science. Why don't you finish your thought?
Yes, because now all the scientists today speak of creation of the universe. It is impossible to have a meaningful scientific discussion of cosmology without the creation of the universe playing a central role. Now, what do all these scientists mean when they say creation? Creation of what? What was created to begin the universe? And the answer was that the scientists have discovered that the universe began with the sudden appearance of an enormous ball of light. The scientists call this the primeval light ball, but it has a popular name, the Big Bang, and that's the name of the theory. And that answers another question. What do we read in the Torah? We read in the Torah on the first day of creation, Vayomer Elohim Yehi Or Vayehi Or, and God said, let there be light, and there was light. The first day of creation, there's no sun and no stars and no moon and no fluorescent lights and no matches and no people. No source of light anybody ever heard of. And the Torah tells us, and there was light. And for 3,000 years, nobody knew what these words meant. And we're told maybe it's spiritual light or something. Light can't be physical light because there was no physical light on the first day.
Right.
And now the scientists tell us, yes, there was physical light on the first day. That's the way the universe began. That is, it takes the scientists, the goyish, atheistic scientists, to teach us that the Torah means exactly what it says.
Huh.
And there was light. That's the way the universe began. In other words, on the first day of creation, the Torah does not report two separate creations, the creation of the universe and the creation of the light, but the creation of the light was the creation of the universe.
So you're saying that that Big Bang, that first explosion of light, is actually described in the very first chapter of Genesis.
The first verses of Genesis.
The first
Let there
few
be
verses.
Light exactly corresponds to
wow.
the sudden appearance of the Big Bang to begin the universe, exactly like the Torah says.
So what's interesting about that is that it would surprise perhaps scientists that actually God did create, despite all their theories.
No, I should say something about God. When all these scientists who speak about creation, they're not talking about God.
They're not talking
the
about
God. The word creation to the scientists means the universe had a beginning. And let me say something about this question about religion. I've quoted several scientists so far. Some are Jewish, some are non-Jewish. The non-Jewish scientists never go to church. The Jewish scientists do not know what a synagogue is. At a matter of principle, I never quote a religious scientist, not in my books and not in my lectures. If the scientist is religious, maybe he distorts things or twists things to justify his religious position. Every scientist that I quote is glatt treif, completely atheistic. So you know this is the pure science. And
right,
I'm like the matchmaker, the shatran. I take what the scientists say, and I take what the Torah says, and I look for a shidduch, I look for a match.
Now, but Professor Aviezer, you're telling me that these are atheists, complete
Absolutely.
Atheists,
complete.
And yet they are saying that the world was created, that there
That's
was
right.
a creative force. Explain to me how that works, because I don't understand.
They will tell you the world sprang into being spontaneously. Nothing to do with God. It's spontaneous. It popped out of the vacuum. This is possible according to quantum theory. This is not against science. And that's what they say. What happened? These are atheists who do not believe in God. I never quote religious scientists. It is important that the atheists, what they say, corresponds to the Torah. So no one's twisting things. No one's making it fit. No one's distorting things to pretend it fits. This is what the atheists say. I quote them. I don't distort what they say. That's what they say. And what I say happens to correspond to even Silk. Joseph Silk mentions this. He says that the, I quote, the Big Bang is the modern scientific version of creation. It means biblical creation. To him, it's a curiosity. It's no meaning whatsoever.
Okay, now, what about dinosaurs?
What about dinosaurs? When everybody asks, when it gets to the fifth day of creation, everybody wants to know, what about evolution? What about Darwin's theory of evolution? What does the Torah have to say about Darwin's theory of evolution? And the truth is, the Torah doesn't deal with theories. The Torah deals with facts.
What happened? Right.
And the Torah has a factual description of the origin of the universe, which sounds completely impossible and crazy. What does the Torah say? The Torah says, we're now on the fifth day of creation. The Torah says, Vayomer Elohim yishrutu hamayim nefesh chayav ashrutu hamayim leminayim. And God said, let the waters swarm with the living creatures. And the water swarmed. If we take these words literally, you can easily get the impression as if the Torah is telling us that at the beginning of the animal kingdom, all the oceans and all the seas were suddenly filled with marine creatures in vast numbers and all different types. The Torah is not speaking about microscopic creatures. The Torah is speaking about normal, large, developed creatures. And all this happened at once, let the water swarm. And that's how the animal life began. Not only is this Torah description completely against Darwin's theory, as is well known, Darwin's theory speaks about the gradual development evolution of the animal kingdom. Nothing happens suddenly. We start with microscopic animals, one, two, or three cells. Only in the course of long millions of years did they develop into large advanced animals that we observe today. So not only is the Torah description completely against Darwin's theory of evolution, it's against common sense. Who can believe this? Who can believe such a thing that suddenly all the oceans and all the seas became filled with marine creatures in vast numbers and different kinds, and this happened suddenly? Who can believe such a thing? Well, Judy, I am happy to be able to tell you that the scientists have discovered that exactly that's what happened. I didn't say evolution didn't occur. Note my words. I said Darwin's theory of gradual evolution doesn't fit the facts. The scientists have discovered that the fossil evidence is incontrovertible. It's absolutely clear that at the beginning of the animal kingdom, all the oceans and all the seas were suddenly filled with marine creatures in vast numbers. And the scientists have given this a name. The scientists call this the explosion of life forms. I repeat, the explosion of life forms. And every scientist who writes about this writes in complete astonishment what the fossil evidence says. One scientist writes, quote, a tremendous explosion of marine life occurred, end quote. Another scientist writes, quote, the period ushered in an explosion of life forms. I'll give you just one more quote. Another scientist says, the most astonishing, quote, the most astonishing aspect is so many radically different types of animals appeared in such a short interval at a rate that has not been matched since. And I give more quotes in my book. This happened exactly like the Torah says. And what explanation do the scientists say? What is their explanation for the explosion of life forms, let the water swarm? This was the subject of an article in the Scientific American. Scientific American is the most prestigious journal in the world for reporting advances in science to the educated layman audience. What's important, Scientific American, it's not some science editor that writes the article. It's a scientist himself who writes the article. And the scientist chose as the title of his article, quote, the puzzling Big Bang of animal evolution. The expression Big Bang is, of course, borrowed from cosmology. Right. Only the expression Big Bang did the author find appropriate to describe what happened. And he writes in the article the following, quote, a remarkable burst of evolutionary creativity gave rise to all multicellular animals. And later on in the article, why and how this occurred remains one of the great mysteries of biology. This is a scientific explanation. One of the great mysteries of biology. Well, to us Jews, it's not such a mystery, because that's what it says in the Torah.
Exactly as it's described.
What
wow.
happened. And my book is full of examples like this.
Okay, so in your book, you describe how actually the scientists show that marine life was Big Bang, exploded, just as the Torah describes
it. Let the water swarm, and swarm they did.
But what about the rest of animal life?
What about the rest of it? They were from the beginning of life, animals evolved later to form the rest of the life, which is exactly what the Torah. People have the impression that the Torah says that Every species was the result of a separate act of divine creation. But if you open a Chumash and you read what the Torah says, something totally different. The Torah says, and God said, Vaya'as Elohim et chayat to art him. And God made the beasts of the field and the cattle and the creeping things. He doesn't say he created them. He made them. If I say I made a table, no one will think out of nothing I made a table. To make means to take something primitive and to make it more sophisticated. That's what make means. That's exactly what evolution says. You start with primitive, simple animals, and they develop into more complex animals. So this is called, in fact, there's a term for this in theology, guided evolution. That we believe, I believe, the Torah says, that the animals were made, they were evolved, but they were evolved under the guiding hand of God.
So basically what you're saying, Professor Aviezer, and correct me if I'm wrong, there are two terms used in the Torah. One is bara, which means created.
Right.
And one is asa, which means made.
Which means made from something else. Now,
okay.
The word creation appears three times in the first chapter of Genesis creation. It appears at the beginning, God created the universe, which is creation from nothing. And it appears at the beginning of living creatures create life. And it appears with regard to the creation of man.
Life,
creation doesn't have to mean physical creation. Something so totally different from anything that occurred before. We used the word creation. He created a masterpiece. He did this. Created, so life, living cells are so totally different from lifeless chemicals that only the word created is appropriate to describe the transformation from lifeless chemicals to living cells. And the third time creation appears with man. Man is such a unique creature, but that requires a whole long discussion. It's the longest chapter in my book. What means the creation of man in this evolution? And nothing happened gradually. Everything happened suddenly a few thousand years ago, but that's a whole story all by itself. Everything else in the first chapter is taking something which exists and changing its form to make something else.
But let's go back to the question that I asked you before, which is dinosaurs.
Dinosaurs, yes. What about dinosaurs?
Well, dinosaurs appeared in fossil life well before humans were on the...
Of course, that's what the Torah says. The Torah says that the dinosaurs are called chayat oret, wild animals. Dinosaurs are an example of wild animals
before
humans.
And yet they were already extinct before the sixth day when humans were created?
Right.
And how do you explain that? I mean, dinosaurs were on the scene for quite a bit longer than a day.
You want to know about the time scale, right?
Okay, I guess that's what I'm asking.
Right.
Tell me about the time scale.
Everything exactly fits literally but the word day. In the 6 days of creation, the word day does not mean a 24-hour period. It means a period or an age of undefined time in the development of the universe. And it's not Natan Aviezer who's saying this. Maimonides, the Rambam, wrote two big masterpieces. One is the Yad HaChazakah, which is his book of laws, Mishnah Torah, and the second thing is Moreh HaNevuchim, Guide for the Perplexed. It's his Torah ideology and telling you what belief, what Judaism is all about. And he devotes a whole chapter to this question. Part 2, chapter 25, everybody should read this chapter. And this chapter tells us that not every word in the Torah has to be understood literally. That's the difference between me and the creationists. The creationists think every word has to be understood literally. And Maimonides, the Rambam, says this is not the Torah point of view. And his example happens to be the creation story. So according to the Rambam's point of view, the 6 days of creation are six periods and not 6 days. But you still can ask the question, well, if it means period, why does it say day? And the answer is the Shabbat. What follows the 6 days of creation? The Shabbat. What is the purpose of Shabbat? We read in the Torah, we say in Kiddush every Friday night, Zecher Lemaaseh Bereishit, to remember that God created the universe. Once a week, you're supposed to sit down and think about God created the universe. And since the Shabbat really is a regular day of 24 hours, the phases of creation, first of all, they divide into six phases instead of seven or five or three, corresponding to the 6 days, and they're called days to make more tight the connection between the creation story and Shabbat. And in fact, you have to say this, because it doesn't only say first day, second day, third day, it says that there was morning and there was evening. Now, a day you can say is 24 hours on my watch, but morning and evening are astronomical events associated with the sun. If there's no sun in the sky, there can be no morning and no evening. It says before the sun appeared, it says there was morning and there was evening. But if you say a day means 24 hours, how do you explain morning and evening?
Right, the sun wasn't even created until...
Right, if you say that the days are phases, we speak of the dawn of a new era, the sunset of an era, it fits very well.
Okay.
So therefore, for all these reasons, there's nothing wrong with saying that the 6 days of creation does not mean 24-hour periods. It means six phases or six...
Eons
in right. the creation. And Rambam is not the only one who says the day sometimes doesn't mean the day. Rashi says the same thing. The book of Hosea, chapter 6, verse 2, the verse says that 2 days and the third day, and Rashi says the 2 days means the two periods of the first and second temple, and the third day, Rashi says it means the third period of the third temple. So there was nothing anti-Jewish or anti-religious by saying the day doesn't have to mean 24 hours. And everything else, but every event exactly corresponds to what the scientists have discovered.
Now, you also answered my next question, which is the age of the universe.
The age of the universe is 13.8 billion years.
Meaning each of those 6 days was...
Was a period.
A period.
Of undefined length.
An undefined period. And when we count the age of the universe as 5,774...
Right. What happened a few thousand years ago? And that's a very interesting question. I have a whole chapter, but I can summarize it on 1 foot. He says that civilization did not develop gradually. Civilization developed suddenly. For thousands and thousands of years, modern man, Homo sapiens, living what they call hunter-gatherer. You're living like a chimpanzee. And suddenly, a few thousand years ago, suddenly, civilization developed. This is so dramatic that the scientists give it a name. They call it a revolution. This is the famous Neolithic or agricultural revolution. Suddenly began agriculture, suddenly became animal husbandry, suddenly became language, suddenly became a wheel, suddenly, pottery, prepared food, a whole bunch of things. Suddenly means plus or minus 1,000 years, and they all occurred so suddenly that the scientists call it a revolution. This is the famous Neolithic revolution, civilization, which means city-making. Suddenly they began to live in villages and in towns and in cities, and all this happened suddenly a few thousand years ago, and that is, in my view, what it means to creation of man. So it doesn't care about physically standing up 2 meters, 6 feet high with eyes facing forward. It doesn't interest the Torah. It interests the Torah what's in your skull. Creativity and intellectuality and all these things that we associate with man and distinguishes man from the animals, that happened suddenly just a few thousand years ago, and that's the creation of man, and that's related to our counting of 5,700, whatever, about 6,000 years ago. That relates to our counting. It's a little more sophisticated than that. I can't tell you all of the details, but that's what the creation of man means suddenly. And it says so in the Torah. In the second chapter, it says, at the creation of man, it says in very interesting words, it says, "Vayitzar Adonai Elohim et Adam afar min ha'adama, vayipach be'apav nishmat chayim, vayihil ha'adam lenefesh chaya." And God formed man from the dust of the earth, and he blew in his nostrils a soul of life. And this is what man means. That's the verse. And this shows that man is a combination of the physical, the dust of the earth, doesn't mean dirt, it means a physical creature. And in this physical creature, it could have existed a long time ago, it doesn't matter. God suddenly imparted a soul, nishmat chayim, to a physical creature. And that's what constitutes man. The spirituality occurred suddenly. And the man today is the combination, the coherence of the physical and the spiritual, and this did not develop gradually over tens or hundreds or millions, thousands of years. It happened suddenly, and it happened a few thousand years ago. Every commentary, when it talks about what's man, it talks about his speech and his reason and his intellectual capabilities, and that's what means the creation of man.
What about fossil research or bones from Neanderthal man?
Human bones. Straight back
the
5 billion years. That's right. There were cavemen.
Are we evolved from the cavemen?
That is, the human physically Man has devolved just like any other species in the animal kingdom. The Torah does not care about our physical being.
Whether we have large skulls or small skulls, long arms or short arms,
it cares about what is in our skull. There was no physical change at the time of the Neolithic Revolution. The same physical creature suddenly developed spirituality. Hmm. And that, to me, means the creation of man.
Professor Aviezer, I feel like I have 1,000 more questions. You really piqued my curiosity to hear more. Can you give me information about how I can acquire your books? In the beginning,
oh, yes.
In the beginning was your first book, and your second book was Fossils and Faith.
And then your
most recent book, Modern Science and Ancient Faith.
I will be happy to send anybody who wants it at a discount if they give me a phone call. The book will be shipped to them on the way. My phone is home phone 03-922-6692.
Okay. Or, yeah. If you're calling from outside of Israel, you would call 972-3, and then the phone number is 922-6692. That is Professor Aviezer's home phone number. Wow.
And even if I'm not home, I have a voicemail. Leave message and I'll get back to you right away, and you will be thrilled, I guarantee it.
You want to give your email address as well if people have questions they want to
ask? Yes, my email address is Nathan, N-A-T-H-A-N, dot Aviezer, A-V-I-E-Z-E-R, at BIU, Bar-Ilan University, BIU, dot A-C, dot
Let me just repeat that back to the listeners. If you'd like to correspond with Professor Aviezer and ask him your questions, his email is Nathan, N-A-T-H-A-N, dot Aviezer, A-V-I-E-Z-E-R, at B-I-U, that stands for Bar-Ilan University, dot A-C, dot I-L. Professor Aviezer, we always end our show by asking, what lessons have you learned on your own personal journey that you'd like to share with the rest of us?
I have one major lesson, that the Jew of the 21st century is not required to choose between accepting the latest theories of science or being faithful to our Torah tradition. Today you can have your cake and eat it too. It is a pleasure to be a believing Jew in the 21st century.
No more leap of faith.
No more leaps of faith.
Lovely. Professor Aviezer, thank you so much for coming and sharing your own personal story and sharing your theories with us. I find it fascinating. And I want to wish you the best of godly blessing in the rest of your journey. You should continue with strength and with intellect to spread your message far and wide and help not only Jews, but humanity worldwide recognize that God did create the universe and that there is no discrepancy between God's having created the universe and modern science.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you, dear listeners, for tuning in. This is Judy Simon on Israel National Radio. You've been listening to Life Lessons. Have a wonderful week. What lessons have you learned from life? Here's a life lesson from George Bernard Shaw. Some men see things as they are and ask why. Others dream things that never were and ask why not. These are life lessons learned by famous people. Would you like to hear some more life lessons? Learn from people like you and me who have been through a journey. Tune in to the show Life Lessons with Judy Simon on Israel National Radio.